with Jane and Woodrow Stiles. The date is July 18th, and we're in Allison, Colorado. The interviewers are Walt and Dot Zart. Okay, Woodrow, when did you first begin working as a trader on the reservation?
First, I better tell you where I came from.
Okay.
I was born in Roswell, New Mexico in 1916. I was 3 pounds and a half. My mother and dad didn't know whether I was going to live or not. My mother said, I'll name him after two great men and maybe he'll grow out of his readiness. So she named me David Woodrow. David for my dad and Woodrow for Woodrow Wilson, because I was born November the 9th, 1916, and they had the election on November the 6th, but it took 3 days to get the news back to Roswell that Woodrow Wilson was reelected president of the United States. Then they kept me in front of an oven keep me warm. They didn't have incubators at that time, but they finally took care of me enough that I grew out of my ruggedness, as you can see. We lived at Tatum, New Mexico at the time, and then we moved over north of Grants, New Mexico. My dad ranched over there, but they didn't have schools over there to take care of all of his children, so we came to Farmington and Aztec looking for a place that had schools that he could send his children to school. So we moved to Farmington in 1920, and there were Navajo Indians in and out of Farmington at that time. I went to school with Jacob Morgan. He was the son of Jacob Morgan, a missionary that later became the chairman of the Navajo tribe. He had three boys. It was Wilbur, Irvin, and Jacob. And he was a missionary helper. And I think it was Christian Reformed Church that had missionaries that went to convert the Indians. Well, Jacob Morgan had three boys. Jacob Jr. is the one I went to school with. We called him Poof, but he didn't speak Navajo. He was brought up not to speak Navajo. So was his two brothers. But Morgan lived down by Fruitman. They pump water into to cool the power plant is named after Jacob Morgan. They call it Morgan Lake. That was about my first contact with Navajo Indians. Of course, we as kids talked about them and wondered about them. They all drove wagons with old four horses. Then my dad had a ranch out on what they call the West Diegas. It's about 25 miles south of Farmington. And he was running cattle out there at that time. They had open range, they called it. And it was controlled by the people that had the water for the livestock. And he was running cattle out there, and I would go out to help him go to the ranch with him. And down below where our ranch was, there was an Indian lived there named Sam. And he would come out in the cold winter with just flour sack clothes on, one thing or another. And I asked my dad, how does he stand it to be so cold and not have heavy clothes on? My dad said he was effaced to it. And I often wondered about that. Then as time went along, we moved about a mile east of Farmington, and we had heard stories of some of my relatives being kidnapped by Indians down in Texas or someplace. I had a sister that was younger than I, and she'd be playing in the yard, and you'd hear these wagons come by with Indians in it, or she'd run in the house and screaming. She was afraid they'd want to kidnap her, but they didn't. So that's where I began to learn about the Navajos. Then my oldest sister married a fellow that was working at a trading post called a White Rock Trading Post, or Stony Butte. And he was working for a man by the name of Willis Martin, and had Willis Supply Wholesale House in Farmington. Willis also owned two Gray Hills Trading Posts at that time. Roswell Nelson went out to run the two Gray Hills Trading Posts when he was 18 years old. My brother-in-law, who was Jim Gibson, was operating the White Rock Trading Post. He'd also been at Mexican Water Trading Post, which his parents had purchased and put him out there to run it, and that's where he learned to speak the Navajo language, because there wasn't very many that could speak English. So I went to work for Jim and Bessie at the White Rock Trading Post, and they paid me $18 a month plus my board. I guess they lost money because I could always eat a lot. Candy, I ate my share. I think I ate more than they sold. Drank more pop than they got rid of. But then I was determined that I would learn to speak the Navajo language. So I learned how to ask them, what is the name of this, or this, or this, or this? And I would ask them, and they would tell me. And that's the way I learned. Of course, a young boy will learn things more easily. I guess our hearing is a little better when we're younger. But that's the way I learned to speak the language. And then I would ask my brother-in-law, which he had learned the hard way at Mexican Water. He would say something I didn't understand, and I would stop him and ask him what it meant. A funny thing happened one time. There was a word that is Shadoshifels, and that means I do not know. He was using that word, and I would stop him and say, what does that word mean? And he said, I don't know. That went on for about three times. He'd say, I don't know. So about the third time I said, you do know because you use it all the time. He says, it means I do not know. Of course, he was just having some fun out of me, because I wouldn't hardly let him talk to the Navajos, but if I heard something I didn't understand, I would ask him and stop him and ask him what it meant. But one time there was an old man, I was at the store by myself, and this old man came into the store. He wanted some axle grease for his wagon. We kept the axle grease down under the counter because the lids just set on top of them. They didn't screw on or anything. And they would usually stain whatever shelf you put them on, so we kept them down under there. Well, they had high counters, and this old man couldn't find that axle grease on the shelf. And he kept saying it over and over, and I learned how to say it real well. He'd say, Sinapaspiche, and I'd say, yeah, Sinapaspiche, but I never did give it to him. He went out and got him a stick, and he scraped some off his wagon wheel. brought it in, he put it up in front of my face. He said, "Tonight, I said, Jake, oh, was that what you wanted?" So I went, but I never did forget what acts of abuse was after that. There were two Indians at White Rock that could speak some English, but I was there for 6 months before I knew that they could talk English. But they went to school up at the old Fort Lewis. They educated two boys. One of them was Sam Haney and the other one was Paul Teller. One day he was trading with me, he started leaving, he said, "All right." I knew he'd been to school, but he never did tell me. And this Sam Haney is quite interesting. His wife died, and of course his kids, the children he had by his first wife, they had grown up pretty good. And then he remarried a young girl. And 20 years ago I was talking to this young girl, and she had had 6 children, but she'd sent them all through high school. All 6 of them had graduated from high school, which I thought was a wonderful accomplishment for people like that. Mm-hmm. And Paul Teller had a boy named Sam Teller. He worked at the Two Gray Hills Trading Post. And now his wife and daughters are making the Two Gray Hills line tapestry rugs.
How much do those sell for?
Thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. They can make one rug and buy a new pickup with it, so you know how much they bring. But they're fine like thread.
More of a tapestry weave than they used to.
They work all day and measured an 8 inches.
Well, where was that White Rock trading post?
55 miles south of Farmington.
Okay.
Across the Charcoal Wash. When I first went out there, the old store was down on the Charcoal Wash. And my brother-in-law moved it over about 5 or 6 miles over where the Ohio Oil Company had an oil camp over there at the time. And they had drilled a well and they got hot artesian water. It come out of there at 98 degrees. My brother-in-law bought a bunch of those old shacks and, you know, what they used to have, the oil companies would set up these tar paper shacks, boards and tar paper on the outside. And he bought those and we moved them down there and set up a store. And we also set up a little bathhouse up there where this hot water was going out of the well. We could go up there and take a bath, and the Indians could go there and take a bath. So we had the cleanest bunch of Indians in the country. And have you heard of Lake Valley? Well, it's out there on the Charcoal too. It's a day school they had out there. I used to have a telephone system out there that you'd ring 2 longs and a short or whatever, you know, was your ring. You'd answer the phone. Most of them at party line used to wire them out there. So this Indian was over there at the day school and he was going to use the phone. Well, the day school phone was 2 longs and a short. He must have spent an hour there ringing 2 longs and a short. He thought you'd ring your ring and they would answer. They'd know who was calling. But he was backwards. He had to ring 1 long ring to get to the office in Crown Point.
You couldn't get it to work.
Have you ever been to Crown Point?
No, have you?
Mm-mm.
No, I've heard about it.
Never been there.
I've heard about it.
Crown Point was the Eastern Navajo Agency. They had the agency there and they also had a hospital there. they served all of the eastern part of the reservation. You see, the reservation line's about 2 or 3 miles west of Farmington, then it runs due south until it gets pretty near the Crown Point, and then it jogs back east a ways and takes in Crown Point. But see, the area east of the reservation was reservation at one time. Some president woke up one morning and got mad at the Indians and he took it away from us. But then, in turn, the agent, which was Mr. Stacker, we call him now Taningazi, went out and put allotments all over this area that used to be a reservation. He did 160 acres for men, women, and children. Also gave them the mineral lands. And they just dotted that country with allotments. That's the reason they call it the checkerboarded area.
I have a question for you. When I was talking to Dr. Ellis this morning, he has been reading some correspondence that went back and forth, I think, between Jim Counselor. Did you ever hear him? And
yes, I know him.
Fryer. Okay. And the score of these letters went back and forth, and he was really impressed with Counselor's. He was very straightforward in what he was trying to tell Fryer, apparently, in this correspondence about that part of the reservation and how it was different because it was checkerboard than was, you know, the rest of the reservation. And so he asked me to ask you about Jim Counselor.
Yes. They had Counselor's trading post.
Uh-huh.
And he used to write articles in the paper. I forget the pen name of the year. Do you remember?
Well, wasn't she the one that wrote the book Wild, Woolly and Wonderful? His wife?
I think so.
But I forget what her...
But he wrote on her pen name.
Her first name was...
Austin Yazzie or something like that. I don't remember.
Uh-huh.
But he would write in and use this Navajo name. And they didn't know who was writing it, but he'd tell them the facts of life about it. That's how come the checkerboard area.
Mm-hmm.
They took it away from them, and then the agents had them homestead, you might say, or gave them allotments.
So they actually homesteaded like an American citizen rather than as a...
Well, they didn't have to live on it as long as American citizens did.
Mm-hmm.
But some of those ranches wouldn't let them in their pasture. They'd run them out, so some of the ranches didn't have allotments in there. But you see, there's one ranch up there. I.K. Westbrook's ranch was about 5 miles from White Rock. But he had it all fenced in. The reason he had it fenced in was the government furnished the money to fence it during World War I so they could raise cattle to feed the soldiers with. So then here comes the guys along wanting to put allotments in the pasture after the government had already financed them fencing up the place. The biggest problem they had, the water that ran down through the draws and arroyos and whatnot, went through his pasture and they would spread it out, water the grass, and they would cut it for hay. Then here comes the government along and they got up above his fence and built dams on that one of those arroyos, which cut the water off. They had failed to file on the water right. So that's an interesting note, that if you've got a supply of water, you want to file on it.
Yep. That's for sure. Well, how long did you stay out there?
I think it was until about 1940.
Did you know Navajo pretty well by then?
Well, I married Jane, and she taught me what I didn't know.
I'm not like he was when I grew up at Trading Post. My dad was always too busy, you know, in the store. If we'd say, well, what did he say, or what did he want, what does that word mean? He'd say, oh, I'm too busy, I don't have time to tell you. So we were sort of discouraged, you know, about learning. Now, if I knew all this, I was going to live at a Trading Post after I got married and everything, I would have really tried to, you know, learn more.
How'd your dad learn?
Oh, when he was young, he worked at Trading Posts and learned to speak Navajo.
Which is the oldest trading post, do you suppose, or do you know?
Round Rock, I think, is one of the old ones.
Is that right?
They always claimed Donato was, but I think there's
Hubble, yeah.
And Brett,
Hubble's.
Jane grew up at Star Lake Trading Post.
Uh-huh.
That's out on the Continental Divide. About 40 miles west of Cuba.
Was there a traders organization? Did you guys kind of keep in touch?
They had a traders.
Indian Traders Association.
Association.
And how many do you suppose were active in the time?
All of them.
I mean, at the time the most were active, how many do you suppose there were?
Well, at that time, the trading posts on the reservation were all controlled by a license.
Mm-hmm.
They only allowed so many.
The tribe?
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, it wasn't. It was the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's right.
But see, they only allowed so many, which was a good thing. They didn't have so many that none of them could make any money. They could all make a living by doing it, by controlling it that way. Where if you go into town and you go up to the city hall and apply for a service station license, oh, they'll give it to you. Whether they have too many or not. First thing you know, the service station operators can't make enough to pay their taxes or their help. And they have to close up owing somebody. In the early day, they had three wholesale houses. They had the Gallup Mercantile, which was a branch of Ilfield Company in Albuquerque. And Gross Kelly was in Gallup. And then they had the Farmington Mercantile Company in Farmington. And they also had one in Durango. Was a branch of Ilfield. And they supplied all the little stores around with wholesale merchandise. There was an interesting thing when we went to Mexican water after World War II. And there wasn't but one car out there at that time. We sold Conoco gasoline, but we didn't have to buy it very often, but it wasn't too many people that came by. And this one Indian named Howard McGorton, that means no teeth. And he had this pickup, and he spent all of his time hauling people to go get a medicine man and come clear over to Hamas Elbow or something. No telling how many 100,000 miles he put on that pickup. But he was gone all the time doing that.
In other words, it was a Navajo taxi.
Yeah.
And that's, as the time went along, the younger generation would buy him a car or a pickup. And then they'd need to make a payment on it, so they'd go get grandma or grandpa or their aunt or their uncle. Come on, I'll take you somewhere. You can give me some money to make this payment. And so they'd go take them somewhere. Say, well, it'd be cheaper over at Shiprock. We'd go in there. Well, by the time they bought the gasoline or they blew out a tire or something and made the payment, it wasn't a bit cheaper. reminds me of a story in the early days. There was an Indian out there in Mexican water that heard that hay was cheaper than shiprock. So he decided he'd take his wagon and go in and get a load of hay. Of course, the little old horses couldn't pull a very big load. So he went to Shiprock and he bought him a load of hay, loaded it in his wagon. So he'd come 4 or 5 miles and stop at the camp, feed his horses. The next day he'd make about 5 miles, he'd stop and feed his horses. When he got back to Mexican water, he had 1 bale of hay left. He said, "You know that hay's not cheaper than Shiprock."
Just imagine, it used to take us all day to come in those days from Mexican water to make a trip to Farmington. It would take us all day long in a car.
How far was that?
About 100 miles.
100 miles from Farmington.
And you can imagine, you know what the roads are now out in that country. Mm-hmm. You can imagine what they were.
When did the highway go through?
Oh, it's back in the...
I mean a paved time.
Latter part of the 50s.
Yeah. Did they turn south to Chinle at that time, or...?
There was roads going through there, but they're just two trails.
Mm-hmm. They weren't oiled or anything like they are now.
There used to be between Mexican water and Nenahotso, it was all this solid rock that you went over. Mm-hmm. And boy, you felt every bump.
Well, it would take us... It was 18 miles, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it would take us
a good hour and a half.
Sort of like going Sweetwater.
Sand, rock, and sand. Mm-hmm. That's all there was, sand, rock, and sand. You didn't get stuck while you... There used to be a lot of tourists come by. You know, they'd see that shortcut and had no idea what the road was like. Well, we rescued lots of people coming through there. Fed them and... Well, we met lots of people.
When did you leave trading? When did you stop doing it?
Oh, about... 20 years ago, 22 years ago.
Did you ever know anybody by the name of Bob Cook? He ended up with that trading post at Rock Point.
The last person I knew that was at Rock Point was a fellow by the name of Porter.
Must have been just before Bob, though.
Does he still have it?
Mm-mm. No.
Well, this fellow Porter. I think he had Rock Point and maybe Round Rock. And he came from over in Santa Fe. He had four boy service stations over there, and I think he sold them out to Plateau or somebody. Hmm. And then he went out there on the reservation and got a hold of Rock Point.
Doubt when you asked about the earliest trading posts, surprisingly, there was a real early one in Chinle, too.
That's right.
It was one of them. Within a few years.
Well, Round Rock was one of them. Chinle was another one. Hogback was another one.
Right.
Where did we read? Oh, I have a New Mexico magazine, The Northland, about this Tom Wheeler. It gives a little history in that. Have you ever seen that? Mm-mm. Let's see if I can find it. Gives a little history about the Hogback trading.
Mm-hmm. We lived at Mexican water for about 3 years after World War II. And there was a couple that lived there. Her name was Susan, his name was Teddy. But she was a Hopi Indian. When they were little, they had a drought or something in the Hopi Reservation. They didn't have enough food to feed all their kids, so they gave them to the Navajos. The Navajos raised them. Susie was a Hopi, but she spoke Navajo. But her roots were over in the Hopi Reservation. And she was a nice lady, and so was Teddy. She used to come down and help Jane and help in the house or things like that all the time. Mm-hmm. They wove lots of good rugs at Mexican Water. We bought lots of them. There was a man by the name of Green that came from Boulder, Colorado. He sold his house up there, so he had a little money. He went to the library and studied all about Navajo rugs. Then he went out on the reservation and go down and buy them from the traders. Of course, we was glad to see them come by because we would give them trade for their rug. We was glad to get somebody to give us a little cash for it. About a two-time gold round to get any money out of them. And we didn't used to, if we gave them $25 in trade, we was glad to sell it for $25. Or sometimes we'd have to take a little less. You know, but that just cut down the profit on the merchandise.
What did you tell me the other day about the system of where they didn't use money there? Was that at Mexican Water?
No, that was at Star Lake.
Star Lake.
They used what they call trade money. They call it seco. They have dollars and 25-cent pieces and 50-cent pieces and nickels and dimes. But it was a good thing for them because they could bring a rug into the store and sell it.
Okay.
And you'd give them $30 worth of second money. They would buy what they wanted and they would take it and go home. And maybe they wanted to buy a sheep or something from another Indian. They'd give him their trade money and he could come in and buy what he needed. And it was a benefit to them.
I met this Wheeler.
And
Tom here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's the grandson of the old man.
The Navajo Indians, as I first knew them, had their own economy. The ones that had quite a few sheep would support the ones that didn't have sheep. The one that didn't have sheep would go over and haul this man with a bunch of sheep, a load of wood or something, and he'd give him an old ewe to eat or trade him some sheep or something, or they'd haul him some water and do things for him, and he would pay him with sheep. They didn't have to have sheep, or they could go work for somebody that had them. Which they got along very well until the BIA decided, the Secretary of Interior, his name was John Collier, and the Indians got to where they hated him so bad, they used John Collier as a cuss word. Just like we would say, God damn it, they'd say, John Collier. But what they convinced them to do was reduce the sheep. They said they were overgrazing it. They weren't overgrazing it, they just didn't have enough rain. Anyway, they told them if you'll reduce the sheep and the goats, 6 more years you can run twice as many as you're running now. Which it didn't turn out that way. The way they used to operate, they put their sheep all together in a band, and wherever it rained, they would move the sheep. Like from White Rock, they'd go clear to Crown Point. If it rained over there, they'd follow the rains around. Wherever it rained, that's where they'd take the sheep. And then in the fall rains, it'd rain back maybe at White Rock and grow enough feed so they could winter, you know, through the winter that way. Then they came out with this grazing districts, and they put each one of them in a grazing district. Well, you have to stay here, and you have to stay here. Well, maybe it didn't rain here. Maybe it rained over there, but they couldn't move over there, so that was detrimental to the livestock business.
One of the things that I heard, I don't know if it's true or not, but one of the things I heard was that one of the reasons they started that stock reduction was because they were sure that they were thinking about getting the Colorado dammed, you know, when they talked about doing that, when they started talking about Hoover Dam. And part of the problem was all the silt that the San Juan was dropping into the Colorado River. And they were sure it was because the Navajos were overgrazing, and then this dirt, you know, all the silt was going into the... This was their thinking. So if they could just get them to quit overgrazing, they said, then the silt wouldn't run into the San Juan, and then the San Juan wouldn't dump so much silt in Colorado.
No, you heard right. That was their argument.
That was their argument, but it didn't turn out to be true.
Then they down north of Mexican water on the San Juan River, they had a proposal to put a dam in there just to catch the silt, you know, from going on down. But they never did build it. That silt's been going down there, and it hadn't built Boulder Dam or Hoover Dam or Lake Powell yet either. But that was just one of their arguments of the soil conservation. But you know, if they don't have rain on the reservation or out in that country, if they only had one sheep, it wouldn't be fat. But if it had rain, they'd all be fat. Because that grass that grows out there grows slow, and it has lots of food value. You go out and look at a range out there and you think, well, this is sure terrible. But you look at the livestock that's on it, and they will look good, and you wonder why. But the food value of the grass has a lot of strength to it. Take like down in Louisiana and Tennessee and down there, the grass grow that high, and it grows so fast it has no food value. Mm-hmm.
Kind of like the rainforest. They say the soil in the rainforest is not fertile really at all. It won't grow stuff.
I had a cousin that moved up to Oregon. I asked him how it was up there, all that grass. Well, he said, my milk cow stood out there and grass knee high and had to haul hay in to feed it. So that's the reason they were reducing the livestock. But it didn't work out like they figured it would. In turn, they reduced the man that had 800 sheep maybe down to 300. He didn't have enough to hire anybody to haul him more than water. So that cut those people off. Well, the people that was used to getting their livelihood from working, sharing the sheep, or working with them, lost their income. In turn, they had to get on welfare or food stamps. And then the people that were running that little bunch of sheep wasn't making much. They said, this fellow over here eating better than I am. What am I looking at these sheep for? You know, they didn't pay. And they went through the Depression better than a lot of the white people. My brother-in-law sent a bunch to Peru. That's where we shipped the lamb from every year. And he went over there and they wanted to know if he had a gun. He said, what do you want with a gun? Well, I said, these people going up and down this railroad said they don't have anything. I said, they sleep under newspapers. That was back during the Depression, the hobos going through there, you know. He said they might just want to rob us for something, so they wanted a gun to protect themselves.
Well, how many trading posts do you suppose are still operating on the reservation?
I never did stop to count them.
Still quite a few, aren't there? Even though.
Yeah. Oh yes, they're still operating.
Still an important part of the.
Oh yes.
Of course, it isn't like it used to be, though. You know, the Navajos then depended on the trader for everything.
Yeah.
And they'd have a death in the family, or they'd depend on going to the store and getting credit to get a new robe or something like that, you know, to bury him with, or
remember lots of times at Star Lake, my dad and brother helped bury some Indian. Anymore, they're more independent, you know, they got civilized. They come to the store and get a little credit to buy some gas and go to town and do the shopping. Mm-hmm. That's progress.
The trading posts were a part of the economy. And they could get by, they got by better than anybody. Of course, the trader would credit them against their wool or the lambs or the cattle or the grubs or whatever they had. And they could get by that way. They could run through the winter time. Of course, it took more food in the winter. They usually didn't pay all of their bill in the spring with wool, but they would pay it in the fall with lambs. But they had a ruling on the reservation that you couldn't sell new lambs. You had to keep them to build up their herds. Also, they had a ruling that you couldn't have black-faced sheep out there. You had to have white-faced sheep. And they also did the same thing with their cattle. They wouldn't let them sell off the female ones because they would build up their herds that way and were able to support themselves. And that got by pretty good. They didn't have any welfare or food stamps or anything, those people. One time during the Depression, they brought out some old army clothes. We're going to give them to the Indians. They had a meeting up there on the hill to give them some things, and they wouldn't take them. They said, if we want our clothes, we go down the store and buy them. That was the way they felt about it.
What do you think changed
things? Well, they had more pride.
Well,
it reduced their
livestock business and put them down to bedrock. And now they go around with their hand down. Give me this, give me that. Of course, the missionaries had a lot to do with it. They was always giving them something.
Is that right?
To get them on their side so they'd follow them, their way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And all the Indians were doing had their hand out to them. They didn't believe what they told them. They still don't believe what they told them. It's just what they can get out of them. The missionaries will donate to them, fine. But if they get in real trouble, they go back to their own way of thinking.
One of the funniest things I ever saw on the reservation was the big revival in Jim Lee, big tent revival. And it was one where when they got saved, they immersed them in water. And I watched these two drunks walk in, stumble in to see what was happening. Went right up to the podium where the guy was speaking, and he grabbed him and he went right over the edge and right under in the water. And boy, they came out there just a blowing. They didn't know what happened to them. It was the funniest thing I ever saw.
Did he know that they were drinking?
Oh yeah, he could tell.
He knew.
Oh yeah.
That's the reason he did it, probably.
Mm-hmm. It sobered them up that way, didn't it?
Sure did. I think he made two chalk marks too for two more that been
saved.
Baptized.
Well, do you remember when the at that time, that was before there were any health services at all. You talk about, you know, traditional medicine, but now when did the government come in with clinics or hospitals or anything, do you know?
Well, it was they had a hospital in Shiprock. They had one in Fort Defiance that I know of, and they had one in Crown Point.
I think Ganado have one then or not?
Ganado had a Presbyterian hospital there. I don't know when they started it. But back in the 30s, you see, doctors were having a hard time too. They went to work, two doctors. I don't know why they were brothers, but their name was Lowe, L-O-W-E. And they came to Shiprock to work at the Shiprock Hospital. the reason I know about it, my older sister had a milk leg, I guess they call it anyway. It's a rupture in the veins in your leg, you know, as far as that. And they treated her at Shiprock for that, the doctors did, which she finally got over it, but she still has a little trouble with her ankle. But anyway, these doctors worked on the Navajos had a lot of Tacoma. And they didn't have any way to treat it, and these doctors worked out a medicine that they could treat them with. Some kind of powder that they would give them to put in their eyes, and they cured them of that trachoma, which used to be terrible bad. And so these doctors worked there at the hospital. They made good money. They got $125 a month. Of course, it didn't cost much to live then. But that was one of the things they worked on. They also worked on a deal they called him from Thai gold that they had bad.
Well, that was terrible.
They just get sores all over them.
I've seen that.
Well, they had a hospital at Crown Point. Remember, we were at Star Lake, and they had they also had a nurse, Molly Riebel, that used to come out maybe once a month or twice a month and go to Torreon on and around to visit the sick.
Now, would she come by automobile or horse?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
She drove a car. Mm-hmm. We were still at Star Lake. That was about 36, 37.